As has already been mentioned in this service, tomorrow, of course, is a very special day. Tomorrow is a day on which we honor our mothers. I won't turn to the fifth of the Ten Commandments, but the fifth commandment, as you know, tells us to honor our father and our mother. And then we're told in the New Testament that that's the first commandment with promise. And as I thought about this and thought about the role of mothers and the role of women in the church and in God's plan, I began to realize how significant and how important it is to have good mothers. What a wonderful thing it is to be a mother. What a wonderful thing it is to be a wife. My own mother died almost 2 years ago now, and I have many memories of her. You know, when you've been bereaved like that, the emotional reactions are strange. Somebody once described it as waves of the ocean. You know, the waves come in, when someone has just died, the waves come in very high and very frequent, and as time goes by, the height of the wave diminishes, and they're a little less frequent, but you still feel battered by that wave that comes in. I remember my mother was not a member of the Church of God, but she met church people and very much liked them, and I think of her influence and her strength and some of the wonderful qualities that she had that I hope I have succeeded at least in part in passing on. She was a very intelligent woman, one whose education was interrupted by the Second World War. I'm sure had that not taken place, she would have gone to university. She certainly had the intelligence to be able to do that. She was very kind, very self-sacrificing woman. In a way, she reminds me of that article that Mr. Trotter mentioned on the LHT page, A Mother's Selflessness. If you haven't read it yet, please take a little bit of time to read that. The Bible, of course, calls the church the mother of us all, Galatians 4 and verse 26. We don't have to turn there, but the church there is described as the mother of us all. And that tells us an awful lot about the role of mothers. Mothers are very, very, very important. What I'd like to do in the sermon this afternoon is to take a brave bite at a rather big subject. It's a subject that can't be covered in its entirety in the course of an hour or so. But I've been thinking, because of Mother's Day and a number of other different events, about the role of women. The role of women in ancient Israel, the role of women in the Bible, and the role of women in the Church of God and in our families. And what I'd like to do in this sermon is address a few questions, because people misunderstand the role of women in the Bible. There are a lot of misconceptions and partial bits and pieces of information that go out. Some of the questions that I think are important is, number one, is God a misogynist? Now, I'm glad you're smiling. I'm glad you've been to the church a long time and you know the answer to that one. And yet, you know, there are people who read the Bible and conclude God is a woman hater. Is that true? Is God a woman hater? Is he a misogynist? Question number two, which I'd like to cover at least in part in the sermon, is it possible for a woman to be both feminine and strong at the same time? Can she be decisive and strong and know where she stands and yet be feminine and womanly? Now, it's really a pretty basic question, because in fact it's one of those dilemmas that is there in our culture, and there are some who would answer no. And probably those who are hardcore in the feminist movement would answer, no, you've got to be tough, forget about being feminine. I watched a program on TV recently where there was a woman who was very critical of a man she was talking with, and she said, you just want all of us women to be, you want us to be cuddly. And she didn't like the idea of being cuddly. It was a manifestation of this question that shows up. Is it possible for a woman to be strong and to be feminine combined? Thirdly, how much do women influence the church today through the 20th century up until the early 21st century? How much influence do they have? Now, of course, sometimes when we think about that question, we immediately think of those scriptures in the New Testament that tell us that women don't do what I'm doing right now, which is preaching. We don't have women preachers in the Church of God. We have deaconesses, of course, but we don't ordain women as elders or put them in the role of pastors, because the New Testament tells us not to do that. But that sort of brushes past a very important question. how much of a role do women have in the church today? I think when we stop to think about it a little more analytically, it's really quite surprising how much of an influence women do have. In fact, really, in a sense, well, you can't compare apples and oranges, but I think one could make a case that women have more of a role and more of an influence in shaping the church and shaping the next generation of the church than do men. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. And fourthly, what about the feminist movement? Let's take a little bit of a look at the feminist movement. We know God is not a feminist. We know God is also not misogynist. But let's look at some of the scriptures bearing on this question, the role of women in the Bible. And I want to begin in the Old Testament. If you turn back with me to Numbers chapter 26, unusual place to begin. And I'm hoping you can't guess where I'm going. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. But there's one verse I want to pick up with in Numbers chapter 26. This is the East Texas congregation. Many of you have been in God's church for a long time, so you know the scriptures. Numbers 26 and verse 33. Numbers 26 and verse 33. We discover a very interesting little story here about a family. Numbers 26 and verse 33, we will probably recognize the name of the man, the patriarch of the family. And we're told here in this one verse, now Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, had no sons but daughters. Of course, back then in that kind of a society, sons were regarded as very important. It was patriarchal. It was not like the post-industrial age of ours where women often have careers. The situation culturally was very different. So this was a little unusual. What are the odds? Five of them. I'm not very good with the math, but when you put the five births together and they all come out as female births, it's a little unusual, but this was what happened to Zelophehad and his family. The names of the daughters of Zelophehad were Mahla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they were of the tribe of Manasseh. That A-H ending, by the way, in case you're wondering, is a feminine ending in the Hebrew. So we've got a rather unusual situation. We've got a man who has no sons, and his wife has been reasonably productive, but in each case, it was a woman who was born. And of course, this raised a series of interesting questions. Because back then in that society, the men worked on the land generally, or perhaps in small commerce. Women did not work in the economic system in that sense, so it's an unusual situation. And then it gets even more unusual because Zelophehad, the father, dies, and you've got five daughters, and they're wondering about their future. Now, I'm covering this example because it's an interesting example, and it actually shows us something. It will answer, at least in part, the first question that I posed at the beginning of the sermon. Numbers 27 and verse 1. Rather famous little petition that takes place here from five unmarried women. Numbers 27, verse 1. Then came the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh. So we get the genealogy going back a number of generations, all the way back to Joseph's son, Manasseh. From the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, here were the names of his daughters, Mahla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. They stood before Moses, before Eleazar the priest, and before the leaders of all the congregation, by the doorway of the tabernacle of meeting, saying, our father died in the wilderness. He has not come this far with them. They're there at Kadesh at this point. But he was not in the company of those who gathered together against the Eternal. He was not one of the rebels. That goes back to the Korah event back in Numbers chapter 16. He was not in the company of those. But he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. In other words, he was not part of that conspiracy to undermine Moses that took place earlier in the book of Numbers. He died in his own sin, he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be removed from among his family? Because he had no son. Give us a possession among our father's brother. brothers. Now, here we need to stop and note something, that in a patriarchal type of a structure back then, it would normally have been the sons, and in particular the oldest son, who would have done two things. They were kind of wrapped together. Number one, would have inherited much of the estate, that is, the material goods accumulated by the father, and also have passed on the name. The genealogical line passes through the sons. And so these unmarried daughters are in a very difficult role. They're in a very difficult situation. Back then in ancient Israel, a woman had essentially two places to be, either under her father's roof or under her husband's roof. If she didn't have either of those, there were not a lot of options in that very patriarchal society. But then comes the petition. Give us a possession among our father's brothers. And Moses very wisely admits he doesn't know the answer to the question. So he brings the case before the Lord. This is one of those laws that are referred to as one of the judgments. You know, it talks about statutes and judgments. This is a judgment because it was an instance that had never come up in the community before. At least if it had, we don't have any record of it. This is apparently the first time it comes up. And unmarried daughters, father is dead. Where do they go? What do they do? Verse 6. The Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, the daughters of Zelophehad speak what is right. Isn't that a wonderful thing that we're reading here, and a remarkable decision that came from God himself through Moses? The petition is a good petition. They speak what is right. You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance among their father's brothers and cause the inheritance of their father to pass to them. And speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a man dies and he has no son, then you shall cause his inheritance to pass to his daughter. If there's no son, see, she normally, the unmarried daughter, could have gone to live under her brother's roof. But what if there is no brother? Then she may inherit. Verse 9, if he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, you give his inheritance to his father's brothers. If his father has no brothers, you shall give his inheritance to the relative closest to him in his family, and he shall possess it. And it shall be to the children of Israel a statute of judgment, just as the Eternal commanded Moses. The petition was right, and the inheritance laws are modified at this point. And, of course, later on, and we're not going to turn there, as you probably remember, later on in the book of Numbers, another question comes up. It was an obvious question that is not answered here in Numbers 27. The question would then be, well, if we marry, and we marry into a different tribe, does that estate from our father, who was a Manassite, then get forfeited and absorbed among the tribe of Gad or Dan or Naphtali, or whichever tribe they might marry into? And that question actually gets answered a few chapters hence in Numbers chapter 36. It's also interesting, we won't take the time to turn there, but in Numbers 36, the decision, once again, the same thing. Actually, it was the elders who came to pose the question at that point, whom should they marry? And, of course, back then in ancient Israel, there was freedom to marry across the tribal lines. But in this instance, the decision that was rendered was, okay, yes, they may marry whomever they wish, but within their own tribe, which was Manasseh. So, you know, I wonder whether anyone in this room is descended from these five daughters of Zelophehad. We presumably have a good few Manassites here. So, get on that, what's that name of that TV program, where they trace the genealogies? And ask them, can you trace me back to Noah or Hogla or whoever, or back in the Bible, the daughter of Zelophehad? It's plausible, isn't it? A bit speculative, I don't know for sure, but it's plausible. Anyway, the point that I'm trying to get at here, of course, this is a little unusual. It did cut against the grain of the patriarchal arrangement of ancient Israel. And God said, yes, these unmarried daughters may inherit. Why? Because they had to be provided for. Now, it's a big subject, the whole subject of the role of women in the Old Testament. And we go through all of those laws at Foundation Institute, all the way through the entire Pentateuch. And sometimes we read certain things about the roles of women and some of the things that were required of them and not permitted of them. And they look a little odd from the perspective of 21st century in post-industrial United States of America. You know, I've taught these scriptures for a long time, and I've come to believe that if you look at what went on back then, marriage was essentially a different kind of an institution back then. I think that's an important key to keep in mind as you read some of those scriptures. I don't want to go through all of them, because some of them do raise eyebrows, especially with the young women in the class. But marriage was a different institution back then. True, it was designed for a man and a woman to be together and to love one another and to produce a family. But the laws governing marriage were so different, and the concerns were different. The concern of a woman back then was, where would she be? And this unusual example gave a partial answer for her. Who would provide for her? It was a very different kind of an arrangement. But interesting little law that came into existence back there in the book of Numbers. I'd like to go to another passage in the Old Testament that we're quite familiar with. And let's turn forward to Proverbs chapter 31. Proverbs chapter 31. Again, it's a very unusual passage. Again, the flavor of this particular section of Scripture in some ways goes a little against the flow of things in the Old Testament. I'm not suggesting there's an irreconcilable contradiction. I am suggesting that when we read about the virtuous woman, the Proverbs 31 woman, you know, she's been referred to as the Proverbs 31 superwoman. You ever heard that? You know, I don't know how many of the ladies here think she, I mean, in some ways, if this was a real woman, she was a superwoman. She was a remarkable woman. But there are a lot of things embedded in this poem about a wonderful wife, a virtuous wife, that tell us an awful lot, again, about the role of a woman. And it's something we have to read closely to come to understand, because it tells us that women back then were, how should we put it? They were much more influential, much more decisive, much more significant within the family and within the household than we might think at first glance. Proverbs chapter 31 and verse 10. I'm going to come back and read the first few verses in the chapter a little bit later on, because they bear on this subject as well. But Proverbs 31 verses 10 through 31 is the virtuous wife, the Proverbs 31 wife. We spend a bit of time studying this wonderful poem at Foundation Institute, and we do a little bit of analysis. It's one of those occasions when I let those students loose and allow them to write down and come up with their observations about this woman, what she's like and what she's not like. So let's read through it. Proverbs 31 verse 10, the rhetorical question that begins, who can find a virtuous wife or a woman of valor, a strong, a capable wife? For her worth is far above rubies. And indeed, that's true. By the way, that phrase, virtuous wife, used there, is identical to the phrase that Boaz used of Ruth, the Moabite girl, in Ruth 3, verse 11. Boaz there turns to Ruth and he says to her, I know you are a virtuous woman. And it's the same in the Hebrew. But who can find one? Good question. Verse 11. The heart of her husband safely trusts her. He will have no lack of gain. She's trustworthy. And as we go through this, we see how she's trustworthy. He knows he can depend on her in a lot of ways. Verse 12. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. I remember talking years ago with a man who was a minister in the church, and we were talking about this subject of marriage and the kind of woman that a young man should want to marry. And I'll never forget the phrase that he used as we were discussing this. You know, he said, sometimes young men have a dilemma. Do they want to marry a woman who looks good, or do they want to marry a woman who... thinks good, let's put it that way. which is bigger, which is more important? Good intellect or good appearance? Now, there's nothing wrong with good appearance. For a young woman to be attractive is a wonderful thing. But unfortunately, our society has kind of isolated that as if that were the only consideration. And I think we understand that's not the case. But I remember what this man said to me, and it kind of ties in with verse 12. We were discussing this. He said, did you marry the intellect or do you marry the appearance, the physical appearance? He said to me, and I think about this, both young men and young women, all of us should think about this. I remember what he said. He said, neither of these is true. He said, actually, you marry a heart. You marry a heart. And I've always carried that with me, and I thought about that and passed it on. You marry a heart. And isn't that true? You marry a heart. Because, you know, there are times in marriage when you're not discussing philosophy. And there are times in marriage when, you know, passion is not the most important thing at that given moment. But you are always with a human being with a heart. And I think that works in both directions. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She has a heart for him, as presumably he does for her as well. Verse 13. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. She's hardworking. She is industrious. She is creative. Verse 14. She's like the merchant ship. She brings her food from afar. She knows how to get the best deals when she goes out shopping for food for the family. Verse 15. She rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household. Now, this is going to be interesting as well, because when you read this poem, you're reading very clearly about a woman who's part of a household which is well endowed. They've got money. They've got money. She's got maid servants. But look at what she does. In spite of the fact that she's got maid servants working for her, she rises while it is night. She provides food for her household, her husband and her children, and a portion for her maid servants. Interesting, huh? This is a woman who is not simply sitting there saying, you know, I'm the boss here in this house, but she's pitching in. And in this case, she's apparently providing breakfast for the maidservants who normally serve her. Verse 16, she considers a field and buys it. From her profits, she plants a vineyard. She's confident. She's assertive. Years ago, I heard a minister going through this same passage of scripture. You know, this is quite an undertaking. This is quite a commercial undertaking. And the man that I heard going through this passage, he said, you know, husband gets home at the end of the day and he turns to her and he says, you did what? I don't think so. I think actually she's made a good investment. He probably turned to her and said, well done, honey. You made a good decision there. She considers a field and she buys it. She girds herself with strength. She strengthens her arms. She perceives that her merchandise is good. Her lamp does not go out by night. She's constantly alert and aware of the needs of her household. She stretches out her hands to the distaff. There's an old English word. She holds her hands hold a spindle. The distaff was used for knitting or creating fabrics. Verse 20, she extends her hands to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy and presumably makes contributions to the poor and the needy on her own. I don't know that she necessarily stopped and called her husband on his cell phone and said, may I make this contribution? He trusts her, as we read earlier on. She's not afraid of snow for her household. All her household is clothed with scarlet, verse 21. So back in verse 20, we read about how compassionate she is. And verse 21, we read about how capable she is and well-prepared she is. Last year, I had the privilege of going to Israel with a group of church members, and we stopped off at a place called Bethlehem Village, where they've got a reproduction of what a village back then would have been. It was people representing this role, shepherds, and they showed a woman working at the spindle, and she had different balls of yarn, including a bright red one. And I looked at that and I thought that this is what's referred to in verse 21. Her household is clothed with scarlet. We read that and it looks as if you're just talking about the color. No. It's more than the color. What's referred to there in verse 21 is actually the quality of the fabric. It was the quality of the fabric because the scarlet was a particularly expensive dye. Pretty impressive image of this woman, huh? Verse 22, she makes tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. She's a woman of class. She knows what's good quality. Verse 23, and I find this fascinating. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. And here, when we cover this in class, we have a bit of a discussion about that particular verse. Is one of the reasons that he's known in the gates because of the kind of woman she is? I think so. It's not a disconnected thought. See, she is doing things that help form and shape and improve the quality of his home life. And therefore, he becomes prominent. He's respected in part because of what his wife does. Verse 24. She makes linen garments and she sells them and supplies sashes for the merchants. She's got her own home business, if you will. Verse 25. Strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. Question. Do women teach spiritually? Do they? This scripture tells us, yes, they do. The image here, think about it for a moment. What kind of an image do you get coming to mind when you read verse 26 here? She opens her mouth with wisdom. She's got wisdom in her mind, in her heart. And on her tongue is the law of kindness. Don't you get the impression of mom with her young children beginning to teach them about God, beginning perhaps to go through a few of those narratives and wonderful stories in the Bible and explain them to her? It's worth us asking ourselves, when a mother does that for her young children, how much does that influence account for? How much of an influence does she have in shaping the way her children think, in introducing her children to the concept of God, in shaping their temperament? I've often wondered to myself, who shapes the temperament of children, mother or father? Well, probably both. They both have a critical role. But when we look closely at some of these examples, we see how influential she is with her children. She watches over the ways of her household, verse 27, and does not eat the bread of idleness. Again, the indication, she's very hardworking. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Isn't that remarkable? Everybody recognizes what a wonderful woman she is. Hardworking, wise, capable. Her husband also, and he praises her. This is a pretty good family situation. And verse 29 is apparently a quote. It's in quotations in our New King James Bible, if you've got the same kind of edition as mine. This is likely what her husband says about her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. He's kind of proud of her. Isn't this beautiful? Verse 30, charm is deceitful, and beauty is passing. No matter how many vitamins you may be taking, time takes its toll. It just happens. But a woman who fears the eternal, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. Remarkable poem, and it ends by saying, acknowledge her for the kind of woman she is. Give her of the fruit of her hands. Matthew chapter 7, verse 20, tells us that by their fruits you will know them. And we do know many fine, influential Christian women by their fruits. But this poem, I think, is really pretty impressive because it answers an important question, and it answers a false concept that can at times develop in Christian circles, that is, a Christian woman is a passive woman. If there's one thing this woman is not, she is not passive. She's just, you know, a doormat. She's there producing babies and nothing more than that. Well, how would you describe her? What adjectives do you think you'd like to use? I would probably select adjectives like confident, capable, trusted by her husband, femininity plus ability and strength. Yes, I think so, don't you? Femininity plus ability and strength. And again, I think this is at the heart of the female dilemma in the 21st century for young women, you know, where we've got so many unbalanced examples of what a woman is to be. And the Bible actually presents us with balanced examples and tells us that the woman can be a Christian woman. She can be both feminine. She can be capable. She can know where she stands on the things that matter, but none of this violates her role as the wife of her husband or as a Christian woman. A lot of lots of other examples, of course, in the Bible that we could turn to. But before turning to a couple of the other examples, I want to take a look at the beginning of this chapter, Proverbs 31, the first 9 verses. We're already there because we don't often read the early part of the chapter. But when we consider this question of mothers and Christian women, the early part of the chapter is very important as well. Proverbs 31, beginning in verse 1, because this is words of advice being given by mom to her son, whom she loves deeply and whom she loves dearly. Again, who influences more? Well, it's apples versus oranges, I agree. You know, sometimes I think to myself, well, you know, I do a bit of preaching. Our pastors preach, several, maybe 3 Sabbaths out of 4. And preaching to God's people is a very special responsibility. It is a sacred responsibility. But we should never overlook the other influences. After all, the sermon only lasts about an hour, right? And sometimes we're glad of that, I know. The sermon lasts about an hour, maybe 70 minutes. How long does the influence of a woman with her children last? And how influential is that in determining what the temperament of the kids will be like, what they learn about how to handle their own emotions as they go through childhood and up through those difficult years of adolescence? I submit to you those things are really very, very important. And that's one of the reasons we should be grateful to the mothers among us. Proverbs 31, verse 1. Let's take a look at this. The words of King Lemuel, the utterance which his mother taught him. Nobody is sure who Lemuel was. He appears to be Israelite because it is Lemuel. El is God. And so he appears to be an Israelite man. He is an ancient, wise individual. This is wisdom literature. He is a chacham. You know what that is? A chacham. A chacham is a wise guy in Hebrew. Not in the sarcastic sense, although it has been applied in the sarcastic sense as well. But he is an ancient wise man. He is a wise man. And his mother taught him certain things. She loved him, and she wanted him to make good decisions. Verse 2. What, my son, and what the son of my womb, and what the son of my vows? She desires that he would do well in life. She feels affection for him. She passes on good advice. The son of my womb. She remembers that moment of closeness and intimacy before parturation when he was the son of her womb. Isn't this remarkable? It depicts the intimacy and the closeness of the relationship. And the son of my vows. One of the NIV study Bible has the answer to my prayer. Perhaps she had to wait to bear a son. Maybe. We don't know for sure. A little bit like Hannah and Samuel in 1 Samuel chapter 11. The answer to my prayer, the son of my vows, is a close relationship here. Verse 3. Do not give your strength to women, nor your ways to that which destroys kings. She's trying to prepare him for responsibility. She wants him to have the wisdom and the good judgment of a king. And in that first line, it looks a little curious. What is she saying? Is she telling him, you know, don't go out on dates, don't get married, remain the perpetual bachelor? No, I don't think so. What that means, don't give your strength to women. She's in fact advising him, you know, if you meet women whose influence on you is not a good one, a godly one, don't let your strength go off in that direction. All of this has to do with influence. Don't give your strength to women, nor your ways to that which destroys kings. Verse 4, it is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink. And she's trying to foster in him good judgment, good judgment. Learn good judgment. Don't get drunk when good judgment is needed. And we might add here, this is very good advice for everybody, don't get drunk when you're choosing whom to marry. It's a good idea to remain very sober. But of course, it goes a little bit further than that, doesn't it? And of course, good judgment is called for young men and young women in this matter. Good judgment. verse 5, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. She's preparing him for a role in which he has to administer justice and make good, strong decisions. And she wants him to develop that ability in judgment. Verse 6, give strong drink, on the other hand, to him who is perishing, and wine to those who are bitter of heart. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. Of course, alcohol can have an anesthetic effect. We should not abuse alcohol, but this is someone who's getting ready to die and is in great pain. And of course, they didn't have modern anesthetics back then. She's saying, no, don't let the strong drink cloud your judgment. There might be a better use for it for someone who's about to die. Verse 8, open your mouth for the speechless in the cause of all who are appointed to die. Good judgment again. Open your mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor and needy. Plead the cause of the poor and needy. She wants him to have good judgment and to learn compassion and to recognize when someone is poor and needy and deserves encouragement, maybe even a charitable donation, deserves a little bit of favor. It's very, very important pieces of advice here. The woman wants the best for her son, and she's passing on the best advice she can. That article, again, Tom Clark's article, A Mother's Selflessness. Mothers have a role that in many ways is selfless, in many ways is carried out appropriately by wanting the best for their children, both their sons and their daughters. There's a sacrifice in being a mother, no doubt about it. There's a sacrifice in being a mother. And yet, when we look in the Bible and we look at this role of wives and mothers, the Bible is very clear that to be a wife and to be a mother is a very honorable thing. Again, our society has kind of turned that upside down. Somehow we've gained the impression that, you know, if you're not earning money, you're worthless. You know, and yet there are times, especially when there are little children there, that mom's role is very, very important, and presumably she's not earning money, at least not at that stage of her life. I'm not suggesting that a woman should never have a home business or even have a career outside of the home. We don't say that, but nevertheless there are times in life when being there for children, being a mother, being a wife, being a, what's the euphemism, a domestic engineer, is a very, very honorable thing. And I hope we understand this. I hope this has not become diluted among God's people. Let's go to another example in 2 Timothy chapter 1. 2 Timothy chapter 1. Let's turn forward to the New Testament. It is an honorable thing to be a mother. 2 Timothy 1, beginning in verse 3. Second Timothy 1, beginning in verse 3. Fascinating thing here. Of course, there are two pastoral epistles written by the Apostle Paul to this young man, Timothy. And when we read the entirety of the two epistles, we discover this was a man who was used very effectively by Jesus Christ in serving in the church. But the background is unusual, and again, it raises this very important question about the role of Timothy's mother. 2 Timothy 1, beginning in verse 3. Let's begin in verse 2. To Timothy, a beloved son, Paul regarded him spiritually as his son. There was a close relationship between Paul and Timothy. Grace and mercy and peace from God the Father and Christ Jesus our Lord. Paul's normal salutation. Verse 3. I thank God, whom I serve with a pure conscience, as my forefathers did, as without ceasing I remember you, Timothy, in my prayers night and day, greatly desiring to see you, being mindful of your tears, that I may be filled with joy. Now, there's an awful lot going on there. But first of all, we see that in a relationship between Paul and Timothy, again, there was a very, very close spiritual bond, father-son, if you will, brotherly bond. Paul remembered him, prayed for him to grow, pray for his success, mindful of Timothy's tears. Apparently, Timothy was not Clint Eastwood. He was not afraid to show emotion at the appropriate time. that I might be filled with joy. Verse 5 is where we get to the interesting part. When I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you. Timothy had genuine faith, real faith. He knew where to put his faith and his confidence. And where did he learn that? From mom and from his grandmother, which dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded is in you also. That genuine faith, you learned it somewhere. Again, it raises an interesting question. Sometimes teaching is not verbal. Sometimes teaching is not verbal. Sometimes teaching from men and from women comes from something other than what is verbal. A person of faith radiates faith. They're not preaching all the time. They're not standing on a street corner or even with their kids preaching about faith and telling the kid over breakfast Jesus Christ is going to come back and set up the kingdom every single morning. No, faith is something that exudes from a person, a Christian man, a Christian woman, because of what's inside of them and what they believe. And Timothy got it from his mother Lois. It was first in his grandmother Lois and his mother Eunice, and now in Timothy as well. Paul commends him for that chain of faith, in this case passed down through the maternal line. Keep your place here in 2 Timothy chapter 1. Let's turn to Acts chapter 16 and verse 1. Acts 16 and verse 1. We get a little bit more information. We'd love to have more information about exactly how this all worked. Again, we can imagine, you know, Eunice, his mother, when he was an infant, teaching him, maybe going through some of the stories in the Bible and going through them and explaining them with love toward her son, Timothy, and infusing genuine faith in him from an early age. Acts 16 verse 1 gives us a little bit more of a detail. Then he, Paul, came to Derbe and Lystra, and behold, a certain disciple was there named Timothy. It's the same Timothy, according to the commentators, who the son of a certain Jewish woman who believed, but his father was Greek. So Eunice was a Jewish Christian woman, apparently, in the church. His father was Greek. And we don't get the father's name. And we don't know for sure what this means. Does this mean that his father was not in the church, or is it simply reflecting the fact that he had a Jewish mother and a Greek father? My own feeling on this is that this probably is a hint that his dad was not in the church. That this probably, I can't say for sure, probably is an indication that he learned the faith through his mother Eunice and his grandmother Lois. I lean in that direction. We can't say for sure. But anyway, let's go back to 2 Timothy chapter 1. And verse 6, because it's the remainder of this little exhortation to Timothy, which is interesting. Verse 6, Paul says to him, "Therefore I remind you to stir up the gift of God, which is in you through the laying on of my hands." The Apostle Paul had that gift of God. He had the Spirit of God from the laying on of hands. And Paul had to remind Timothy to stir it up. We all have to do that from time to time, don't we? Sometimes we need to shake ourselves a little bit, stir it up, strengthen the Spirit of God inside of us. But then there's this very famous verse in verse 7, 2 Timothy 1, verse 7, that we've cited a lot. But tie it in with what we just read a couple of verses earlier. "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." Much to be said there. Very important verse. These are characteristics of the Spirit of God. Timothy had the Spirit of God. But the question, of course, is when you put those few verses together, was he spiritually strong the way he was because of the influence of his mother and his grandmother? Sure looks that way. That was a big part of it. This wonderful chain of faith passed down through the maternal line. Well, there are many examples in the Bible that one could cite, and many positive examples. There are also a few negative examples. Now, of course, we know human nature is the same in men as in women, but I'd like to look at a couple of other examples that are not nearly quite so positive. Let's go back once again into the Old Testament to the time of King David. And we remember that when King David was on the throne, it was an amazing time. He worked justice and judgment, as the scriptures tell us. He was quite a remarkable king. He conquered just about everybody in the neighborhood. When King David died, check it on a map sometime, check it out. King David died, and the territorial extent of Israel was enormous. And it was enormous in the early part of Solomon's reign as well. It was very unusual. From that point forward, it's all downhill. And of course, after Solomon, the kingdom fractures. Anyway, King David had a very successful reign, in spite of course, the mistakes and the sins that he had. But as we move through that, and he made a mistake, of course, the sin with Bathsheba, at a certain point in his reign, things went out of control. And they went out of control because of certain individuals. Remember Joab and his brothers? And you remember, we all remember it, of course, I'm not going to take the time to go there, but Absalom, this very good-looking son of King David with the shock of curly hair, and, you know, everybody, I imagine the women all went crazy over him and were all in love with him, and he at one point began undermining his father David. And Joab pursued him. And David said to Joab, "Leave him alone. Don't kill him. My son, I don't want you to put him to death." And what did Joab do? You remember, of course, Absalom caught in a tree with all of this hair on top of his head, and Joab killed him, contrary to David's instructions. Now, this is leading somewhere. I'd like you to go with me to 2 Samuel 16 and verse 10. 2 Samuel chapter 16 and verse 10. It's again, when we see all of this, once again, what I'm trying to get to, and we haven't got there yet, is the role of a particular woman who doesn't get a lot of press in the Bible. 2 Samuel 16 verse 10. 2 Samuel 16 and verse 10. The king said, Abishai, verse 9, 2 Samuel 16 verse 9, Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said to the king, "Why should this dead dog, Shimei, curse my lord the king? Please, let me go over and take off his head. I'll cut off his head, I'll kill him." David says, "No. What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? Let him curse. The Eternal has said to him, curse David." Remarkable little image there. 2 Samuel 19, verse 22. 2 Samuel 19, verse 22. Someone figures here. A person that maybe we don't think about very much. 2 Samuel 19, verse 22. And David said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should be adversaries to me today? Shall any man be put to death today in Israel?" Again, it's Abishai who wants to kill Shimei, the one who cursed David. 2 Samuel 2, verse 18. 2 Samuel 2, verse 18. What I'd like you to notice is the individual who is associated with Abishai and Joab. 2 Samuel 2, verse 18. "Now the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Asahel. And Asahel was as fleet of foot as a wild gazelle. So Asahel pursued Abner," and then I believe Abner turned around and killed him. But anyway, we've got the three brothers here, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. And the name of this individual, Zeruiah. How much have you focused on Zeruiah? Some of you know where I'm going with this. Who was Zeruiah? This person is mentioned 4-5 times in the Old Testament. I used to read over this and I thought, "Well, Zeruiah's their dad, surely. After all, that's the way the Old Testament normally does it. It traces the lineage through the father and through the grandfather." 1 Chronicles 2, verse 16. 1 Chronicles 2, verse 16. It's a fascinating little piece of history. 1 Chronicles 2, verse 16. We're in the middle of a genealogy here, and I just want to pick out one verse. In verse 15, David is mentioned there. 1 Chronicles 2, verse 15. And now, here is Zeruiah. "Now their sisters were Zeruiah and Abigail. And the sons of Zeruiah were Abishai, Joab, and Asahel, three." Zeruiah was their mother. And David says on more than one occasion, "You sons of Zeruiah, you're too tough for me. You're hard. You're hard bitten." What kind of a person was Zeruiah, the woman? I think probably in our colloquial English, we could appropriately term her a piece of work. Where did they learn this ruthlessness? Joab, another interesting study, we don't have time to go all the way through that, but you've read the history, I'm sure. Joab was a nasty guy. He was aggressive. He was threatening. I don't know how he got in as David's general. They didn't have a mafia back then. But his mother's name was Zariah, and Zariah was a piece of work. Now, sometimes the influence of the women can be very, very negative. One more negative example, and then we want to move on. One more negative example. I've tried to balance this out, okay, so that you know that I'm not focusing on negative examples of the women, because there are many, many positive examples. But there's another negative example. It's interesting. In the Old Testament, when a woman is mentioned in relation to a prominent individual, in relation to a king, you're often left with that little question mark in your mind, why? Why is she mentioned? In fact, this came up in class recently. One of the students raised his hand and said, why is this person mentioned? Let me show you someone else here. Also, a very negative example. 2 Kings 24, verses 8 and 9. 2 Kings 24, verses 8 and 9. 2 Kings chapter 24, verses 8 and 9. There's another example of a woman who is a very bad influence. Women do have tremendous influence over their sons. 2 Kings 24, verse 8. Jehoiachin. Jehoiachin was the grandson of righteous King Josiah, the last great reforming king in Judah. Jehoiachin was 18 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Israel, in Jerusalem, for 3 months, very short reign, and he was actually carted off to Babylon because he did something that displeased Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, and Judah then was essentially a vassal state to Babylon. And then, fascinatingly, it mentions his mother's name was Nehushta, the daughter of Elnathan of Jerusalem, and he did evil in the sight of the Eternal according to all that his father had done. Jehoiachin was... His mother's name was Nehushta, and she's mentioned in a number of places in the Bible. I checked on this. Nehushta means in Hebrew a piece of brass. So she was a brassy woman. She was like that. She was a piece of brass. Doesn't it sound suspiciously like, you remember the snake on the pole? Remember the snake on the pole that Moses put up when the serpents were biting them? Remember the name? They called it Nehushtan. This woman's name was Nehushta. They called it Nehushtan later on. The two words are apparently related. I only discovered that yesterday in preparing for this sermon. Jeremiah chapter 22. Jeremiah 22. So we see that what we're seeing here is the influence of women, and in this case, a couple of very negative examples. Jeremiah 22, beginning in verse 24. Jeremiah 22, verse 24. It's an interesting chapter, by the way. The whole chapter is fascinating. There's a list of all the sons of Josiah. There were three sons and one grandson who came to the throne between Josiah and the fall of Jerusalem. Jeremiah 22 and verse 24. As I live, says the Eternal, though Coniah, the son of Jehoiakim, yes, this is one and the same as King Jehoiachin. He is known as Jehoiachin or Jeconiah, or Coniah, even if Coniah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were the signet on my right hand, I would pluck you off. Whoever controlled the signet in the ancient world was very, very influential, because the one who controlled the signet controlled access to the king, and often wrote correspondence in the king's name. In Ezekiel 28, we won't turn there, but Satan the devil, the king of Tyre, typed him. It was described as a signet on the hand of God. Even if you were a signet on my right hand, I would pluck you off. I wouldn't allow you to be in that close relationship with me, God says to Jehoiachin. Verse 25, and I will give you into the hand of those who seek your life, into the hand of those whose face you fear, the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, in the hand of the Chaldeans. He feared Babylon. He was a vassal king to Babylon, and God says you're going to go into Babylonian captivity. But then look at this in verse 26. So I will cast you out, and your mother who bore you, the woman Nehushta, alluded to here in this section, into another country where you were not born, and there you shall die. But to the land to which they desire to return, they shall not return. In other words, Jehoiachin and his mother, Nehushta, were to be exiled to Babylon and not come back. Again, you're left to wonder. you're left to wonder, how much of an influence did Nehushta have on her son Jehoiachin, who was only on the throne for 3 months, didn't have much of a chance to do much of anything, but the Bible says he was a very bad king. He was in rebellion against God. And, of course, many other examples. We can think of many other examples, both positive and negative, of the role of women. Let's go forward now. Go forward to Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2. I'm jumping over a couple of examples in my notes because of the matter of time. I'd like to go forward to Titus chapter 2, where there is a lot of instruction from Paul to Titus in this case about how to work with the church and what everyone's role should be. Titus chapter 2 and verse 1. Paul writes to Titus here, "But as for you, Titus, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine." That's the goal of the ministry. "That the older men be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, in patience." A lot that could be said here. Many, many comments here. But the role of the older men. Of course, we have many older men who fulfill that role in the church today. "The older women likewise, that they be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things." Notice that once again in verse 3. The older women are to teach. No, the women don't preach in the church, but once again we get an indication of the fact that the older women are to teach, no doubt in part by their own personal example, toward the younger women. And of course I think this works very well in the church in so many cases today as well. Verse 4. "That they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God should not be blasphemed." So we've got the older women as teachers of the younger women, and the younger women here instructed to love their husbands. Some women don't, of course, in our society today, but that is the way, the Christian way, and to love their children, and to fulfill these qualities, and of course to take care of the home. Now again, I want to qualify just a little bit because as we saw in Proverbs 31, we saw that example where the woman, apparently she was in the home in that case, but she was running a home business. And we certainly don't claim that women in the world today should never work outside the home. Somebody once asked of a man, "Does your wife work?" And he said, "Well, yes, of course she works. She's working at home all the time. But, you know, sometimes women work outside of the home, sometimes inside of the home." The point I do want to emphasize here is that what's described here is an honorable role. It's a good role. It's the role of a homemaker or a domestic engineer, to use the politically correct term, is an honorable role. And if any of us needs proof of this, think of those instances when you've walked into someone's home and the place is a catastrophe. Have you ever been in a situation like that? I remember years ago when I moved out here to East Texas and I was looking to buy a home. And this had nothing to do with the church, nobody in the church. But we were looking at big homes. There was a big house out in Longview. It was a fairly nice house. It was one of these rather old-fashioned, rather dark houses. It was a good size, and the price was pretty good. But I remember walking into this place, and it was absolute catastrophe. There were wrappers from cupcakes on the floor. And as I recall, there were items of underwear strewn around on the floor as well. All right, it's an extreme example. But, sometimes when young people go away to university or college and they're in the dorm and mom isn't there, all of a sudden they realize, whoa, now I know what my mother did for me. The role of maintaining the home, keeping the home clean and ordered, preparing nutritious meals, caring for the home and the husband and for the children. This is a very honorable occupation and very, very formative. And I really hope that in God's church we don't lose that. We don't lose sight of that. We should never, ever think that a woman who is staying at home to look after her children, maybe her children are not yet of school age and she's looking after them, she's taking care of her husband and running things at home, is somehow inferior. The scriptures don't say that. That our society has devalued homemakers. It's also perhaps raised a little bit too high the matter of how much money is coming into the home. There are occasions when taking a little bit less income and having the home well organized and clean and saving a little money on food and so on, it can be worth the trade-off. Again, it's a very individual decision. I'm not giving a one-size-fits-all, but I am suggesting that for a woman to be a homemaker is a very honorable thing. And we can think of so many examples in the church. We can think of many of the men who've served God in God's church. I'm conscious of the fact this is East Texas, and a number of you have been around the church for quite some length of time. And when you think of those examples, you realize how very significant it was, the wife's role in the ministry. And you've all heard it said, the wife is 50% of her husband's ministry. What does that mean? What does that mean? Does that mean that the wife is helping select scriptures for the sermon to be given on the Sabbath? Well, in many cases, no. But when you think about men in the ministry who served God's people effectively, and you think about the temperament, the willingness to serve, the hospitality, the kindness, the femininity, the reputation of the minister's wife, I don't know whether that's 50%. I suppose it depends on how you measure it. But it does get to be very, very significant. I've known people, you've known people, men who were in the ministry, and their wives are not supportive at all. In some cases, they were simply not suited to being minister's wives. It's not an easy role, not an easy role. I've known people, you've known people, whose wives were very active and very much contributing to service of their husbands in the church. I think it applies not just in the ministry. I think it applies across the board. It applies in a good Christian home in many, many different ways. I've got in my notes here, and some of you are old enough and have been around the church long enough to actually have known Loma D. Armstrong. Take a look at the role of Loma D. Armstrong at one point. She was pretty active, and she was no floor mat, from what I know about her. She was a pretty assertive woman, but she was very, very influential in the development of the Church of God in the 20th century. She died before I came into the church. I do remember something. Some of you may remember this. I remember back in Pasadena in the 1980s, as I moved out here to Big Sandy in 1990, I can remember Mr. Armstrong taking a Friday night Bible study back in the 1980s, and he made a comment that I've never forgotten. What he said was this. He was actually talking about his own ministry. And he, as I recall, he was going through 1 Corinthians 12, and he got to that section where it talks about discernment of spirits. And I have a pretty clear recollection of what he said. He said, "Now, brethren," he said, "I've not been very good at this." He said it publicly and openly. He said to the people sitting there, he said he had not been very good with discernment because things had happened in the leadership of the church. And, frankly, what he had said was true, and that he was hoping to grow in that area. And then he mentioned specifically that his late wife, Loma D. Armstrong, had that discernment. And from what I read about her, and I never met her personally, because as I said, she died before I came into the church. She did. She saw through people. She saw what people are like. She could pick out people who were not sincere, and she could pick out people who were sincere and who were genuine. And I think that was a very, very great asset to the church as long as she lived. There are many other things that she did as well that she did for the church. It's just one example, just one rather important example of the role of one very unusual Christian woman in the church back then, in the 20th century. So the role of women is perhaps much more significant than we realize, and the role of mothers is really very, very formative. Let's wrap it up then. Just a few comments to wrap things up. We read in the book of Titus, we read about how a woman is to love her husband and to love her children and so on, her role within the family. I didn't touch on this all that much, but I think we know clearly that Christian femininity is not the same as feminism. It's not. At the heart of the feminist movement, I'm not saying all feminists are like this, but at the heart of the feminist movement is a disdain for, and at times even a hatred of men. If you've never met women like that, please steer clear of them. You don't want to go near them. You don't want to be influenced by them. There are such women. Christian femininity is not the same as feminism. Christian femininity can be strong and decisive. Feminism is different. Feminism is hard and resentful and defiant in some ways. I learned something interesting. The Mother's Day Proclamation, 1907, Anna Jarvis of Philadelphia. Check it. I didn't copy it into my notes. But actually, there's a very much a feminist thought at the heart of the Mother's Day Proclamation, the time when Woodrow Wilson was the president back then. The concept was, actually, you can look it up online. You can find it on Wikipedia. The concept was, if women were in charge, we wouldn't be going through world wars. That's what it said, essentially. Of course, it's not true. But you even hear that echoed today. You know, if women were in charge, not all these people would have died in these terrible world wars. No, it's not true, because human nature is the same between men and women. It doesn't vary. So Christian femininity is not the same as feminism. And of course, the feminist view of a woman's role really is incompatible with what we've looked at in the scriptures. Point number two, as we've already mentioned, it is possible for a woman to be both strong and feminine. The dilemma is dissolved when we study the scriptures, when we find the complete description of the role of a Christian woman. It is possible. And let's add to that a very, very great blessing for a woman, a mother, or a wife to know where she stands as ethical challenges, moral challenges, questions of the law of God come along in a Christian home. That's a very, very good thing. And conclusion number three, to be a wife, to be a mother, to be a homemaker is an honorable occupation. Critically important for the development of the family. Critically important for proper functioning of the Christian home. Critically important for the passing on of Christian values to the next generation. So, maybe tomorrow you're going to make mom breakfast in bed. Let's never forget, we love and we appreciate our ladies, we appreciate our mothers, and we acknowledge their important role in the development of the family and within God's church.